this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And right now, of course, I'm asking you to hold your calls. Your telephone number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY at 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We'll open up at the very end of the program. Mr. Dreyfus, who's our special guest this evening, can only be with us for about 40 minutes. But Mr. Robert Dreyfus has written a fascinating book called The Devil's Game. Now, have you ever wondered where this whole radical Islamic movement came from? I mean, did it just sort of come out of nowhere? Did it really begin when Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen were fighting in Afghanistan in the 1980s? Or where did it really begin? Well, Mr. Dreyfus has traced the history of this movement back to really the 1860s, 1880s, to another time and another era. And I think you'll be surprised at how this whole thing came about. Mr. Dreyfus, thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's really my pleasure.
And now, remember, this is a different audience, so you can repeat everything you've said before, and I think they'll be fascinated. First of all, how is it that you happen to write this book? Because it's a very important book. We needed to get into the background of what's the origin of this radical form of Islam that is really a threat to the survival of Christian civilization today.
Well, you know, like any religion, Islam has had conservative and moderate and liberal and free-thinking versions going back centuries. But really, I would say in the 20th century, there started to emerge an organized force of what I would call the Islamic Right. These were groups that were ultra-conservative, but also organized in a political way. And you can date it, I guess, for the sake of argument, with the founding of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in the 1920s. And by the time of the Cold War, the Muslim Brotherhood had grown into a fairly significant organization in Egypt and other countries from Syria and Jordan and Pakistan and elsewhere. And during those years, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the Muslim Brotherhood often worked with some of the most reactionary elements in the region, got funding from Saudi Arabia's ultra-conservative Wahhabi clergy. They developed relationships with the various kings, like the king of Egypt, Farouk, and also with the British. The British saw these Islamic groups as potentially useful allies in battling some of the anti-colonial movements and the anti-imperialist forces that were trying to get the British out of Suez or out of India and so forth.
And, of course, they really were not interested in Arab nationalism. They really wanted sort of an Arab internationalism, but they were quite willing to make common cause with the British. And wasn't British intelligence and then sometime later the CIA involved with helping these organizations, this radical Islamic movement?
That's right. When the Cold War started, after World War II, and the United States started to replace the British as the main power in the region, the United States started to see these Islamic groups as allies.
And, of course, I think this is the part of the story that nobody likes to talk about today, that at least as you read the book, you find out that many times it was American money that was helping to actually foment this whole radical Islamic movement. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and perhaps could we, before we get too far into what's going on today, how about let's go back to the very beginning. You describe a gentleman named Afghani. Afghani wasn't an Afghani at all. Apparently he was a Persian, but this was, what, the 1860, 1880 period? Would you like to go into the background there of where this really began? Of course, we always had the Wahhabis, but then there was this other gentleman who played such an important part as the forerunner of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, Afghani is a very important and fascinating figure. He died in the, the 1890s after a 30-year career as almost a whirling dervish organizer. He traveled from Persia to Afghanistan to India to Egypt to Turkey. He spent years in Europe. And he founded along the way a whole series of pan-Islamic secret societies.
No, pan-Islamic secret societies. So there really were secret societies involved in this then?
Yes, they were, sort of underground movements of people who did not admit, publicly that they belonged to these movements, but they had a kind of a secret knowledge. And this was not... This is, common at the time. There were Freemason movements and others that existed at this point, some of them quite innocuous, others perhaps more political. And Afghani interacted with them as well, various Freemason lodges in places like Cairo and in Turkey. But he was really the architect, the first one who came up with this idea of a political movement to unite Islam. But it wasn't as, pristine or honest as you might think, because he tried to sell this idea with varying degrees of success to the British and the Russians and others who were engaged in a fairly high-stakes, what they called the Great Game at the time, struggling over the Middle East and Central Asia, competing, that is, the British versus the Russians, in competing for influence in that part of the world. And Afghani proposed, especially to the British, who apparently helped him during important parts of his career, to try to unite the Muslims in alliance with Britain in kind of a pan-Islamic bloc that would be pro-British and would support London's efforts against Russia.
Hold that thought right there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfuss, and we're talking about his book, Devil's Game, which we think is a very important book, and it goes into the background of a man, and we've been talking about him. His name was Afghani. He was really a Persian, but he was trying to pose as an Arab, and he was really pushing this idea of pan-Islam, or uniting the whole world, and something called a caliphate, something would really unite the Muslim world against the rest of the world. But he was using British intelligence. He himself was a Freemason, but he had contacts with British intelligence, and then, of course, apparently he was, had contacts with the Russians. He was willing to go any place that he could get support. But actually, didn't he end up as the prime minister of one of the countries over there for a time?
He became prime minister of Iran for a while, and he was eventually kicked out of Iran, and one of his followers ended up assassinating the Shah, who was a long-time king of Persia until the 1890s, and then he ended up dying a few years later. But he left a legacy. He was sort of the ideological grandfather of this pan-Islamic movement. Now, I should say, by the way, there's nothing wrong with uniting Islam, just the way there's nothing wrong with uniting the 50 states of the United States into a republic. But this was an explicitly political plus religious effort that had a very, perverted notion of what Islam really means. It's an originalist kind of 7th century version of an Islamic empire that imposed an outlook which was very anti-modern, which certainly would not fit with modern learning and science and political freedoms. So here was a case where it was an explicit attempt to bring that part of the world really backwards, away from the modernizing outlook of the 19th and 20th centuries. And his followers were primarily based in Egypt. He spent years there himself, and he had a follower, a man named Abdu, Muhammad Abdu, who again became very close to the British colonial powers in Cairo. Abdu, in turn, was the godfather politically of a man named Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brotherhood in 1928. And it's widely recognized by scholars of Islam, political Islam, that Afghani, Abdu, and Banna, those three, are kind of like grandfather, father, and son in the movement that created the modern version of political Islam. And of course, what gave it a big boost was after the Saudi Arabian Kingdom was established, also in the 1920s, and also, by the way, by the British, the Saudis became the financial backers of the Muslim Brotherhood for the next, 75 years, I would say, until 9/11. And so Saudi Arabia, which was based on this very ultra-Orthodox Wahhabi version of Islam, found that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt was the best expression of that outside of Saudi Arabia. And so the Saudis and the Muslim Brotherhood became kind of an alliance which has lasted for many decades. And it was this alliance that the United States encountered when it was looking for allies in the region in the 1950s that were both anti-communist and opposed to some of the upstart nationalists like Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And so for these two reasons, because the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi Wahhabis were strongly anti-communist, and because they were strongly anti-nationalist, they got American backing, and we played various political games with them over the years. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Afghan Jihad, which was the most pure expression of that alliance. But, you know, in my book I go into many other examples and background on how this theory developed of Islam as a barrier to communism. And, of course, the problem with all this, you can say, well, anything goes during the Cold War. I happen to think that playing with religion is extremely dangerous. It's not the same thing as paying off some colonel or buying, you know, funding some political party or something, because religion is a very uncontrollable force. And, of course, then we found out after the Cold War that these religious fundamentalists had their own agenda. They weren't just anti-communist, but once the Soviet Union was gone, they turned and expressed the anti-Western component of their political and religious philosophy.
Well, before we get into that, and I think that's a very important issue, but I just want to get back to Afghani, and I thought one of the most significant things I learned from reading your book is that Afghani, the father, or the grandfather, as it were, of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations after Afghani, was presiding and there in the Middle East, and that we had the Muslim Brotherhood created in 1928. But Afghani kept talking about Allah and about the Islamic faith and professed this deep belief. And yet, you pointed out that he really didn't believe in Allah, he didn't believe in God. It was really all about a political struggle, about a power structure. That was really a very interesting point.
Yeah, he believed, apparently, in the what analysts have called the political utility of religion. In other words, He believed in the secret truth and then a public truth.
In other words, he was talking about the dedicated belief to Allah and the dedication to this going back to it was at the time of the Prophet, but he really didn't believe it at all. It was simply used as a vehicle to get ahead?
Yes, well, I don't know about to get ahead. That's true in terms of his personal ambition, but I think he viewed it more in the sense that the masses are too uneducated for me to explain to them the way that I'm thinking politically. So I have to create this myth for them to bring them together around this notion that they can grasp that the Quran is the political constitution and not just a moral or religious document. And so by proposing that publicly, he was preaching to the masses, while within his own circles, we know from reading his letters and other things after his death, he really had no use for religion. He was what he was called then a free thinker. Whether he was an atheist or not, I don't know. Perhaps that's the best way to describe it. But he was somebody who saw religion as a tool rather than as a fundamental true belief system.
And I think that was really so important, that he really was using religion and this whole idea to pursue an agenda that he had. And you know, as I read your story, it, obviously there was a powerful force around this. I mean, anybody can get up and talk about religion, but you don't get to be the prime minister of a country. You don't get to travel all over. You don't get the following he had unless there was some sort of a force behind him. Did you ever have that feeling as you analyzed this? Was this his brilliance? Or was this his charisma? Or was there some sort of a force that was pushing him?
No, he clearly latched on to the imperial powers. His main voyage, which brought him to public prominence, is when he traveled from India to Egypt aboard a British vessel, where he was, you know, shown great deference and was clearly brought over to Egypt by British intelligence, because they believed that he was a charismatic figure and someone who was willing to work with the British colonial office to advance British interests in that whole area between India and the Mediterranean that they consider the heart of their empire.
And so really the British were using Afghani was using the British. Was that the force then that you think was propelling him?
Well, for most of his career, I would say that's true. And certainly when he was in India, certainly when he was in Egypt, for a time he lived in Paris, and he published a journal there called The Indissoluble Bond, and that became one of the landmark newspapers or magazines of the pan-Islamic movement. And apparently at that point he was getting some support from the French secret services. He also went to Russia and tried to get the Tsar's support. Apparently he had somewhat fickle loyalties. But I would think, aside from his voyages to France and Russia, I think primarily he was allied with the British during most of his career.
All right, Father, there are listeners out there. This is a gentleman named Afghani. And, of course, Afghani then was the grandfather of the Muslim Brotherhood, because it was two generations later than in 1928 when the Muslim Brotherhood is created in Egypt, and this becomes the father of what we really see as Al-Qaeda today. And, of course, Muslim Brotherhood was aligned with Saudi Arabia. And then after the Second World War, the United States was backing both the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia and the Muslim Brotherhood. because they were opposing the Arab nationalists. And of course, many times the Arab nationalists were not anti-communists, and this is one reason why we dislike Nasser so much, and of course why we oppose Nasser, because I don't think he was a communist, but he certainly was not pro-Western. Anyway, we'll be back in this in just a moment or two, because this is an important part of the history. If you don't understand the past, you can't understand the present. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and for our listeners, Nasser came to power in 1952 or 1953, and then ruled up through 1970. He played an important part in the crisis that occurred in the late 1956, when, of course, they had the revolt in Hungary, and at the same time they had the attempt of the British and the French to seize the Suez Canal. But you tell the story. You know it far better than I do. Where does Nasser fit into this whole thing? Where does the Muslim Brotherhood fit in as far as Nasser is concerned?
Well, at first, I think the United States and the CIA under President Truman looked somewhat favorably on Nasser, because they thought that the king of Egypt was a decrepit old man and someone who couldn't hold the country together. But Nasser came to power at a time when all over the so-called third world there were stirrings of anti-colonial leaders and independence-minded leaders and so forth. Certainly Nasser was not a communist. He appealed to the United States first for military aid and arms, and he appealed to the United States for economic aid to build the Aswan Dam. But by the time the Eisenhower administration had come in, we had leaders in Washington who didn't like independent-minded leaders like Nasser, because even if they weren't communists, they weren't willing to join alliances, and that was the word of the day. We were creating military alliances, and so was the Soviet Union, which had the Warsaw Pact, where we set up NATO. We were creating CETO and CENTO and the Baghdad Pact, and Nasser didn't want any of that. He certainly wasn't joining those Soviet alliances, but he was appealing to the United States, support me as an independent leader, and there were people in the CIA who agreed with that, who said, yeah, Nasser is the future of the Arab world. He's modern, he's charismatic, he has a lot of influence. But in the end, the British view and the French view prevailed. And we supported the colonial powers. We tried to replace them in places where they were withdrawing because their empires were shrinking. And so Nasser became viewed as someone who was untrustworthy, dangerous, and unreliable. And of course, Nasser, after getting turned down by the United States when he tried to buy arms in the West, turned to Czechoslovakia, which was part of the Soviet bloc. And that confirmed the worst suspicions of the British and the Americans, who said, aha, you see, he's a communist after all. And so from that point on, there was a continual effort to undermine or destabilize Nasser, to weaken him. And because of the power of Islam, the Muslim Brotherhood was by far the strongest opposition force inside Egypt. And so the United States, and especially the British, which were still then strong in that part of the world, started playing around not only with the Muslim Brotherhood, but with Saudi Arabia, which supported these Islamist forces in Egypt.
And so basically what we were doing was trying to destabilize Nasser's government. We wouldn't like anybody coming in here and trying to destabilize our government, but we went into Egypt and we tried to destabilize the man who was running that and really wasn't doing too bad a job, trying to improve the lot of the tragic people there within Egypt. And of course this takes, well, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus, and we're talking about his book, The Devil's Game. That's Robert Dreyfus. The book is The Devil's Game. And, you know, I think it's very, very important that there's one wonderful quotation in the book, but from Nasser. He's writing to President Kennedy. He's saying, you Americans never make stupid mistakes. You make complicated, stupid mistakes. So we can't figure out that maybe we've missed something about what you're doing.
Yeah. You know, the turning point in the relationship with Nasser and the Muslim Brotherhood was in 1954, the Muslim Brotherhood tried to assassinate Nasser. And he struck back at the organization with, you know, full force of his police and his security services and forced many of their leaders into exile. But at that point, the United States still had the choice of supporting or opposing Nasser. And the quote that you referred to really refers to Nasser's surprise when we suddenly, in the United States, opted to support King Faisal in Saudi Arabia, who was busily trying to create an Islamic bloc. And we had the Eisenhower Doctrine, which closely bound us to Saudi Arabia, which was seen by almost every Arab as a reprehensible, greedy, and dissolute monarchy, and yet that became our principal Arab ally. So we aligned ourselves with the worst, most despised forces in the Arab world and ended up opposing Nasser, who fought a series of overt and covert wars against Saudi Arabia, most notably in Yemen. There was a war that raged throughout the 1960s in Yemen between Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And throughout this, the Muslim Brotherhood was the principal opposition force inside Egypt. So the idea, and we now know that Saeed Ramadan, for instance, who was one of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, had officially signed on, according to German archives that have been uncovered and other work that's been done by me and a reporter in Switzerland and others. We know that Ramadan was an official agent of the CIA, and I found a photograph of him in the Oval Office with President Eisenhower.
Now, Ramadan was basically the head of the Muslim Brotherhood, wasn't he?
He was their chief international organizer.
Okay.
He'd been expelled from Egypt by Nasser, so he settled in Switzerland, and he set up a Islamic center in Geneva, which became kind of the nerve center for the worldwide Muslim Brotherhood. I don't think he ever achieved the title of, leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. That was reserved for someone who stayed in Egypt.
Oh, no, but of course,
he was their main organizer.
How did he finance this? Was he financed, do you think, by the intelligence agencies when he was in Switzerland? Because you just don't go to live in Switzerland, you know, and then put out a magazine. You got to have money.
Well, it was more than a magazine. He had a whole institution there, a major Islamic center, but it was heavily funded by Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
The Saudis and the king of Saudi Arabia personally put a great deal of money into Ramadan's work.
Well, of course, are we backing Saudi Arabia? Are we doing everything we can to keep them in power?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, we were most of all interested in the oil and not the royal family.
Well, but of course, the royal family was the key to the oil. We had
absolutely.
The contracts. American companies had contracts with the royal family, so we were going to see they stayed in power, even though they were ruthless. I mean, they mistreated women. They cut off people's hands and heads and all sorts of... just like the Taliban was doing, really.
Well, not only that, but massively corrupt and so forth. And it wasn't just that we had contracts at the time until the mid-1970s. Saudi Arabia's oil was actually owned by the four big American oil companies. The company Aramco was completely owned and operated by Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, and Texaco. And the Saudis didn't even have any say in it. This was at a time when the oil companies ruled international oil, and none of these Arab countries or OPEC didn't even exist until much later. I mean, this was at a time when the oil companies really ran the international oil business and were the real kings of Saudi Arabia.
And, of course, well, basically that we were backing the people. The Saudi government was backing the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course, the Saudi government was backing the Wahhabis, and the Wahhabis and the Muslim Brotherhood are really the foundation of what we call Al-Qaeda today, aren't they?
Yes, it's several generations from the time we're talking about until Al-Qaeda was formed, but ideologically, the Muslim Brotherhood grew ever more radical as time went on.
All right.
Refined its ideology.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game. And basically, could you explain to our listeners why you call it Devil's Game? You know, because what you're really inferring is that we sort of created the devil, or at least we work with the devil.
Well, I see the words Devil's Game as really referring to a game that you can't win because the other side is devilish or has stacked the deck against you. I think when you play with religion, you're playing with a force that is far more volatile and dangerous, kind of like nitroglycerin, than just normal political games. And so I think ultimately it was a devil's game because we were destined to be outflanked and outfoxed and to lose. And I think that's what ultimately happened when the movement of political Islam grew faster and extended broader than we ever believed it could and in many respects, got out of control, sometimes without us realizing what was in fact happening.
Well, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood still seemed to be more or less centered in Egypt. And, of course, as time went by, of course, we're in the 1980s, then, of course, we have the Muslim Brotherhood actually killing Anwar Sadat, really in reprisal for the fact that he'd signed a peace agreement with Israel. And, of course, then we get the Mubarak who's there today. But certainly the Muslim Brotherhood then has always been in resistance against the government there in Egypt. But we were backing the government on one hand. We were backing the Muslim Brotherhood with the other. Didn't we continue with one hand backing the Muslim Brotherhood at the same time we were supposedly buddy-buddy with Anwar Sadat and then Mubarak?
Well, even Sadat himself. You know, what happened was after Nasser died in 1970, who had strongly repressed the Muslim Brotherhood, Sadat became president. And he brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt, in part to help him create a political base for himself, because he came into power with very little political support. And he, Sadat himself, used the Muslim Brotherhood against the pro-Nasser forces in Egypt. And that's one of the great ironies of history, because he actually brought back into Egypt, led, by the way, by Saeed Ramadan, who we talked about earlier, and financed by Saudi Arabia. He brought the Muslim Brotherhood back into Egypt.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Dreyfus. His book is Devil's Game, and we recommend the book. And if you'd like to know more about it, well, you can give us a call at 1-800-454-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you really need to get the interviews we've done with Mr. Dreyfus. Give you tremendous insight into the background. But Mr. Dreyfus was talking about how Anwar Sadat, after Nasser died in 1970, then, of course, Sadat comes to power. And what does he do? He brings back the outlawed Muslim Brotherhood. Now, I think he had actually been a member of that, hadn't he, or been affiliated with it?
Yes, in the 1940s, Anwar Sadat was a member of the Brotherhood, and for a time, until it was banned, he was Nasser's liaison to the Muslim Brotherhood.
So he comes into power, Sadat comes into power, he wants to use the Muslim Brotherhood as his political base, and so he brings them back in. They've been outlawed, they've been driven out of Egypt, he brings them back in, and then what happens?
Well, they he allowed them and, in fact, encouraged them and even provided government funds for them to take over a number of institutions, and they began to take over the Lawyers Guild and the Engineers Guild and various medical societies. They began to establish themselves in universities. They started to create Islamic banks. It was like they began penetrating almost every part of Egyptian society, and people who went to Egypt at this time were stunned at how this country, which had been so secular in the 1960s, 10 years later, had become so religious, and men wearing beards and women wearing headscarves and covering up. And so this penetration of the Brotherhood went into every nook and cranny of Egyptian society. And
well, didn't they more or less force this upon the Egyptians? In other words, it wasn't necessarily they wanted to, but weren't they just sort of using almost intimidation to get everybody to go along with a more radical form of Islam?
Well, I don't know if that's true, Dr. Stan. I think that you'd find that there was a ready-made constituency for this outlook, in part because people were poor and angry and frustrated, and of course there'd been the catastrophic loss of the 1967 war with Israel, and a lot of people blamed Nasser for that defeat, and so the ideology of Arab nationalism had been greatly weakened, and people were looking for answers. And so then the Muslim Brotherhood comes and says, Islam is the solution. That was their slogan, and it was appealing to a minority, perhaps, of the population, but certainly a significant minority. And they gained strength, and Sadat encouraged them. And then they spawned ever more radical offshoots and branches. And it was one of those, namely Egyptian Islamic Jihad, that turned around and assassinated Sadat in 1981. So he only lasted 11 years as president. And I guess the most ironic thing about that is that when Sadat was assassinated, he was busy helping the CIA bring together worldwide Islamic radicals to fight in Afghanistan. He was shipping Egyptian radical Islamists to Afghanistan. He was training Afghans. He was, this was a blunder of colossal proportions for Sadat, because he was working with the very forces that ended up killing him.
But of course, we were doing the same thing. We, during the Afghan war, the CIA was recruiting these radical mujahideen, these holy warriors, from all over the world and bringing them to Afghanistan and indoctrinating them in this radical form of Islam. And, you know, we've even got some material. I don't know if you know John Cooley's book on holy wars. He talks about how the CIA was distributing Korans to these fighters, and you know, it was the battle against the infidels, kill the infidels. Weren't we actually promoting this radical form of Islam in Afghanistan during the 1980s?
Well, far worse than distributing Korans, which I wouldn't personally object to. We were teaching them how to make car bombs. We were teaching them how to do assassination.
And we were actually training them, some of them, right here in the United States, and then sending them back again. I know I had Colonel Bo Greitz was teaching a lot of these Afghans right over here in the desert in Nevada. Of course, we're not supposed to be involved in other people's affairs, and we were determined we were going to wage a war over there. It was a CIA war.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And of course, it wasn't just Afghanistan. There were many people in the Carter administration and then in the Reagan administration who believed that Islam was a sword that could strike at the Soviet Union itself by rousing up the Muslims of Central Asia. And that became kind of a mini crusade for a while. The idea that the Soviet Muslims in what's now Uzbekistan and Tajikistan and the other Central Asian republics, Kazakhstan, well, all of those countries were then part of the Soviet Union. And so while this fighting was going on in Afghanistan, there was this notion that maybe it would inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union to rise up. So we were completely oblivious to the fact that we were creating a permanent radical religious army.
So like Dr. Frankenstein had no idea what he was creating.
That's right. And even there were people who said after the Shah collapsed in Iran and Ayatollah Khomeini came into power, which was 1979, the same year that the Afghan war started. Well, there were people who said, maybe this isn't so bad because maybe Khomeini will himself inspire Muslims in the Soviet Union. And I found a great quote from Zalmay Khalilzad, who's now our ambassador in Iraq, in which he wrote for the RAND Corporation about 1980, a paper saying that maybe Ayatollah Khomeini will be the undoing of the Soviet Union, and he is creating an Islamic movement that is already being felt in the Soviet Union and in Iraq. Now here's the man who's now the ambassador to Iraq, dealing with that Islamic fundamentalist power that he was 25 years ago lauding and praising because it was going to weaken the Soviet Union and weaken Iraq, which was seen as a Soviet ally at the time.
Well, it's a fascinating, fascinating story, and I certainly commend you for writing it. I'm going to let you go because I know you have something else, but I just wanted you to briefly mention the relationship between the CIA and Israel and Hamas. Now, Hamas, everybody knows, is the enemy of Israel. Hamas is already radical. It's sort of an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood, this intense hatred of Israel. But didn't some of the Israelis play a hand in creating Hamas?
Oh, that's a fascinating story, and you're absolutely right. I mentioned earlier how Nasser had suppressed the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, at the time, what's now Gaza, the Gaza Strip, came under Egypt. And then in 1967, the Israelis occupied Gaza, took it over, along with the Sinai Peninsula, of course. And when they went into Gaza, where there were many thousands of Palestinian refugees, they freed all the members of the Muslim Brotherhood who'd been arrested by Egypt. And one of those was Ahmed Yassin, who was a radical preacher who founded Hamas in 1987, 1988. Well, this was back in 1967. And for the next 20 years, the Israelis encouraged Yassin. They helped the Islamists in the West Bank and in Gaza build a political force that they thought, the Israelis thought, would undermine the PLO and Yasser Arafat. Now, not all Israelis, by the way. I've been told, and I put in my book, that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, thought this was completely dumb for the Israeli military occupation authorities to support the Islamists, because maybe they had Mossad had a better idea of what a danger this was. But still, the Israeli occupation authorities went ahead and allowed this movement to prosper. And it grew, and there were even clashes between Hamas, the early Hamas movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the PLO all over the West Bank at universities. So this movement grew and took root and finally established itself with Israeli support, to the great then backfiring result that it turned into Israel's bitterest enemy. And as we know from today's news, the Palestinians are holding elections just about now in the West Bank and Gaza. And it looks like Hamas, if it doesn't win those elections, will do so well that it will cause an enormous problem for Israel, for the United States, and others, who then have to decide how do we deal with a new Palestinian government in the occupied territories that is heavily influenced by Hamas, which is considered a terrorist group, which is responsible for many of the suicide bombings and other carnage in Egypt, as distinct from the other Palestinians who sometimes engage in fighting Israel over the occupation, but try to veer away from suicide bombings aimed at civilians and restaurants and things like that. So you have now Hamas emerging as a major political force in the new Palestinian government. And so I guess the moral of this story is Israel made the same mistakes on a much smaller scale that the United States made on a much larger canvas. Their canvas was really just the tiny occupied territories around Israel. But we were supporting, that is the United States, Islamist groups from Morocco to Indonesia into Central Asia, and so on a much bigger scale and much bigger scope.
Yeah, well, we could go on and on, but I know you have another obligation. I hope we can get you on to one of our other programs again, but thank you so very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, and if you don't mind, I've mentioned my website.
Oh, go right ahead, please.
People can go and read not only about the book, but my articles and other things. It's just my name, Robert Dreyfuss, like the actor, Robert Dreyfuss.
That's with two S's?
Yes, Dreyfuss, RobertDreyfuss.com.
Right. RobertDreyfuss.com, fascinating information. Thank you so very much for being with us. I know it's getting late where you are, and we'll look forward to talking to you some other time, but thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Good
Thank
night.
You.
And, of course, we're going to have open lines. We've got about 15 minutes before our next exciting guest, but our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And I'd like to suggest that sometimes a lot of things don't make mistake, or we give this impression, oh, we just made another mistake. Oh, shucks, we just got such incompetent people. And I would like to suggest we do not have incompetent people. We have brilliant people who are orchestrating this whole situation. And if you follow the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, one of the men who planned the assassination of Anwar Sadat was the blind sheik Omar Rahman. And Rahman was then arrested by the Egyptians and thrown into prison. But if you read the book Unholy Wars by James Cooley, who was a reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, he will tell you, as you know, that all the evidence suggests that the CIA got Rahman out of prison in Egypt. And then the next thing you know, why they're making arrangements for him to get a visa to come to the United States. So Omar Rahman is a radical. He's a revolutionary. He's part of this whole radical Muslim Brotherhood. He wants violence. He's preaching violence and killing. So the CIA bring him to the United States, and he gets set up in a mosque, I believe it's in Brooklyn, and the next thing you know, why he's sending over to the Arab countries to get a bomber to blow up the World Trade Center. And of course, eventually he gets arrested and put into prison, but he sets up a whole terrorist system over here. Now, why would the CIA do something that stupid, unintentionally? Why would they get this radical member of the Muslim Brotherhood out of prison in Egypt, get him a visa to get in the United States? You're not supposed to bring terrorists in the United States. Those of you who have never seen the video, Jihad in America, you really need to get it. It was put together by Stephen Emerson. It was first shown in 1994 and then banned. Somebody put orders out it was not to be shown in America, and it was not available at all until after 9/11. Why? Because it's got all sorts of footage in there. It had to be shot by our intelligence agencies in 1988 and 1999 and 1990, and it shows them Arab radicals. Abdullah Azzam, who was the man who formed Al-Qaeda after the Afghan War, he's over in talking in Oklahoma City, talking about jihad and blood running in the streets and the violence they're going to perpetrate here in the United States. And then, of course, he gets killed in 88. And everybody thinks it's Osama bin Laden has done that. I suspect maybe had a little help from the CIA, because now Osama bin Laden takes control of the world terrorist movement. And then the following year, you have pictures of other radical people from Al-Qaeda talking in Oklahoma City and other major cities. They've got pictures of the terrorist training camps, and the government knew all about it. Believe me, they knew who every radical was in this country. They thoroughly infiltrated this whole movement. And this is the one thing that people don't understand. That our intelligence agencies, and there are 14 of them, they're not the CIA and FBI, and maybe the NSA, there are 14 intelligence agencies, they're very effective. We know that they say, oh, we couldn't infiltrate the Islamic terrorist movement, but then we find out that a couple of the terrorists were moving with an FBI informant in San Diego. And of course, they couldn't infiltrate the Islamic movement. They didn't know anything about it. But certainly, this Massoui, he was up there in Minneapolis. He was the 20th hijacker, supposedly wanted to learn how to fly a 747. Didn't want to learn how to take off and land, just wanted to learn how to fly it. And the people up there said, this guy's got to be a terrorist of some sort. If he knows how to fly this plane, he could fly it into a building. They reported to the FBI. The FBI wants to, locally in Minneapolis or Minnesota, want to go through his desktop computer. And the FBI in Washington, D.C. will not allow that. And they checked over in France. They found out this man was a terrorist. He'd been part of the terrorist network. The French knew all about him. And the Americans knew all about him. But the Washington office just wouldn't let anybody go through his desktop computer. And then, of course, we're told, the trouble was our FBI was just so incompetent. I mean, there was the Phoenix memo that had come in, and that was from the FBI station chief in Phoenix, who was saying there were so many of the Islamic people who were learning to fly planes that he thought maybe they were preparing for a terrorist attack. But Washington, D.C. just couldn't connect that, couldn't connect the dots. How many times have you heard that? And they're lying. I personally interviewed the woman who ran the flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, and she told me that 11 days before 9/11, the FBI was there checking on Zacharias Massoui. They knew everything about him. He was somehow or other tied into a man named Nicholas Berg. You remember Nicholas Berg? He was that fellow that was captured by the radical Islamists and beheaded. He was wearing a official army jumpsuit, the most amazing thing you've ever seen. How many terrorist groups do you think have orange jumpsuits like they have at Guantanamo? We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. One of the hardest things for people to understand is that so much of what goes on today is all manipulated. The battle between communism and capitalism was manipulated from the very beginning, and those of you who have read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, will see from the very inception of communism in 1917 and 1918, it was largely financed by American corporations and American banks, and we're getting all sorts of support from key people, figures were here in the United States. Get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it. There's a wonderful article there by, actually it's just excerpts from a book called Imperial Agent by, our British agent perhaps it is, by Bruce Lockhart, who was sent to Russia in 1918 by Lord Milner, who headed Cecil Rhodes Secret Society at that time. And Bruce Lockhart can't understand why he's there, and wherever it is, St. Petersburg, I guess it is, Lenin is coming to him for advice, and to a man named Fred Thompson, who represents William Boyce Thompson, head of the Federal Reserve System, or a member of the Federal Reserve, and he and this other American are called into all the communist meetings, and Lenin is coming to them for advice, and poor old Bruce Lockhart doesn't understand how the game is played. All he's there is just to relay information on what's going on back to Lord Milner. But, of course, if you read a lot of the literature that came out at the time of the revolution, many people think that Lord Milner was behind the revolution and intentionally brought it about. And then you get into, of course, the consistent funding of communism since its very inception. Nothing as it appears to be. Recently, in this last week or so, it's come out that the number two man of the Irish Republican Army, this vicious group of people who are blowing things up and killing people in Northern Ireland, who is actually a British agent. The chief torturer, this is another gentleman, who tortured people and killed people for the Irish Republican Army over a period of 20 or 30 years, was a British agent. Could it possibly be that nothing is it appears to be? It's only recently come out now that the whole of the IRA from the very, very top was infiltrated by British agents. Here in the United States, we know that the mafia was thoroughly infiltrated by people working for the FBI, and when we get back, I'll tell you the story of Whitey Bulger, a man who killed 20 people and tortured many of them to death right here in the United States, I think it was in the Boston area, while he was in the employ of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the office in Washington, D.C. knew everything about it. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and there's a wonderful book. We don't carry it anymore. It's suddenly out of print, but it's called Deadly Alliance. It was written by a reporter from the Boston Globe, as I remember. Coincidentally, I tried to get on my program, and I think he was afraid to come on. But it was the story about the fact that the mafia in the United States was thoroughly infiltrated by our government and our government agents. And one of them was a man named Whitey Bulger, who for 20 years was an FBI informant with the mafia. During that period of time, he killed over 20 people, tortured many of them to death. The local authorities kept wanting to get him, and the FBI would always, of course, let him know ahead of time so he could escape. And eventually, of course, he did escape, thanks to being informed by his local FBI handler. And Washington, D.C. knew exactly what was going on. They sent an innocent man to prison for 30 years to cover for the crimes of Whitey Bulger. And that's a book called Deadly Alliance. You can probably get it in some of your stores. Of course, if you've read the book Double Cross, which we do have, written by the brother of the head of the mafia, he will tell you how the mafia worked consistently with the CIA. And Sam Giancano, Chuck Giancano's brother, Chuck writes the book. And we have the book. If you haven't read Deadly Alliance, by a Double Cross, why, we do have that one. And you get into the background of this incredible story. How could this sort of thing happen in America? The American Communist Party was thoroughly infiltrated by our intelligence agencies. It was simply a shell here. They were simply watching everything they did. The militia movement here in the United States was largely financed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the other intelligence agencies. And this is the way the game is played all throughout the world. And yet they would try to convince you, oh, shucks, that we had no idea who any of those Muslims were. And then we find out about Abel Danger, and one of our intelligence agencies has known all about Muhammad Atta a year beforehand. In fact, when they actually had the 9/11 Commission hearings, and we have the staff report, they had pictures of Muhammad Atta taking money out of an ATM machine. I believe it was in February or March before the September attack. Where did they get those pictures? They had to be watching him. They knew where all of these people were because one of the hijackers had actually defected to the United States in April of the year 2000. You probably never heard of it, but it was brought out in the initial investigation that was known as the Joint Intelligence Committee investigation. If any of you would like to see the page from the testimony of Elder Hill on the 18th of September 2002, you give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And one of the hijackers walked into the office in New Jersey, FBI office, and said, I'm trained as a hijacker. We've been in Pakistan. They trained us how to hijack your planes. I'm part of a team. We're going to hijack them, and I want to turn myself in. And you know what the FBI did? They gave him a lie detector test. They figured he was telling the truth. They gave him another lie detector test. He passed it with flying colors. And what did Washington, D.C. do? You would think the intelligent thing was to try to get the rest of the hijacking team, wouldn't you? Wouldn't that what a logical person would do? But did they do that? No. In April of 2000, a little over a year and a half before the 9/11 attack, they got him out of the country as fast as they could. Why would they have done that? How did they know within 24 hours who all the hijackers were after September 11th? Nothing as it appears to be. Remember our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And our web space, RadioLiberty.com. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Israel. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Greig, who is formerly the senior editor of the New American magazine. He certainly is a prolific writer. He's written a book, and we'll tell you a little bit more about his book later in the program. He does a blog spot, and certainly we're pleased to have him here at Radio Liberty on a regular basis as we explore the things that are happening today. And since we talked to William this afternoon and we covered what's happening financially, I suspect he's going to want to talk about that again this evening. You must understand, ladies and gentlemen, that we are facing a financial crisis that will touch everybody living in the United States. In fact, I believe everybody living in the entire world today. And the world we've known is very soon not going to exist, at least financially. We're heading into an inflationary depression. It's only a matter of time. If you read the Wall Street Journal carefully, as I do, why, you find out Sprint has a cell phone business. They just wrote off $29 billion. Now, I can't imagine what $29 billion is. It's beyond comprehension, but they've written off $29 billion of debts. And you go into the Citigroup, major bank in the United States. They wrote off $6.5 billion in 2006 and about $18 billion last year. And of course, they're going to write off a lot more this year. This is money that's just disappearing. Banks have to have money so they can lend. And of course, the problem is not a matter of liquidity. It's a matter of solvency. Many of the major banks in the United States and throughout the rest of the world are frankly insolvent. And you can pour all the money you want to into the economic system, as the Federal Reserve and other central banks are doing, and it's not solving the problem. But I'm going to let William pick up the story there and give you his impression of what's going on. William, go right ahead and tell me, and don't be afraid to repeat what you said this afternoon, because this is an entirely different listening audience.
Dr. Stan, first of all, I really appreciate you having me on a second time, and I particularly appreciate the fact that you have been so devoted for so long to the estimable cause of dethroning the reign of illusion and trying to restore the reign of reality. And we're about to have a really severe dose of reality manifest itself here in the United States and everywhere in the world where the economy is linked to that of the United States. You're entirely correct, and in all sobriety and with all sense of due proportion, I think it is perfectly rational to say that we're confronting a world historic economic crisis, and most likely it's going to erupt sometime around the end of the third quarter of this year. And there's simply no way to avoid a reckoning. We know that you can defer a day of reckoning, but at some point you have to confront it. And right now we're seeing the grand unwinding of this entire debt-based system, which is in large measure the financial counterpart of the imperialist or globalist foreign policy pursued in Washington. You really cannot have a republic and a fiat currency system, and you can't have an empire and a hard money system of economy. And so what we're seeing right now is the logical termination of decades of imperialist foreign policy funded by debt-based fiat currency, and it's all going to come to a head probably before the end of the third quarter of this year.
And of course, many of our major banks really are facing insolvency. We're going to lose a lot of banks, and of course, even Ben Bernanke, the head of the central bank, Federal Reserve System, has said a certain number of the banks are going to fall. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. William Greig.
Well, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, when you have a fractional reserve banking system, you have banks that are by definition, insolvent, and most of the time they're able to conceal that fact when the economy is relatively healthy. But at some point, fractional reserve banking is going to be driven to a crisis, but you can buy that, of course, with the fiat money system. And Ben Bernanke is somebody who for decades has preached the idea of classic Keynesianism, which is that basically if you have the prospect of a depression, you inflate your way out of a depression. He's learned exactly the wrong lessons from the stock market crash in 1929, the ensuing depression, and the fact that it wasn't until 1946, this is what Ben Bernanke and people of his ilk don't understand or refuse to recognize, it wasn't until government was radically scaled back in 1946, after World War II, and some sense of normalcy was restored in terms of the size and the expense of government that we started to recover. Most people seem to think that it was the intervention under FDR, the nationalization of whole tracts of the economy, and then the grand public works project called World War II that restored the economic health of the United States. That's patently untrue. It's demonstrably untrue. And that idea has been debunked many, many times by people who are associated with the Austrian School of Economics. But Mr. Bernanke is from the Keynesian School of Economics, and he has said on many occasions that what we need to do if we're confronting a crisis of this sort is simply to supply what they euphemistically call liquidity, which is to say have the Federal Reserve start counterfeiting what is pleased to call money in whatever volume necessary in order to ensure that you don't have bank failures. Well, just last week, Mr. Bernanke, and this is somebody upon whose every syllable the world economic system holds and clings tenaciously, they are suspended on tenterhooks as they listen to everything that falls from the lips of Ben Bernanke. They observe his every facial tic and nervous gesture. Last week, he very blithely said before Congress, quote, there will probably be some bank failures. Now, if he's going to concede that much, we should assume that there are going to be some fairly major bank failures, because this is not a man who is in the habit of yielding to reality willingly. He's somebody who obfuscates persistently, and so when he admits that there are going to be bank failures, we should batten down the hatches and expect things are going to get really ugly really soon. Now, just this last week, I published on my blog, Pro Libertate, an essay entitled Prepare to Panic. And as I explained this afternoon, the title comes from an episode of Get Smart, which was a spy spoof back in the 1960s. And I believe that it was a masterpiece of political satire, that series. And every once in a while in that television series, there'd be something I thought provides wisdom for the edification of people who are trying to know what's really going on.
Well, hold that thought there, okay, for just a moment as we bring our stations back on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William was talking about the remarks made by Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank here, and the Federal Reserve System, to the effect that there would be some bank failures. We could anticipate that. And then, of course, William was referring to a episode of Get Smart. I don't know how many of you remember it, but it's one of my favorite favorite programs. That was a 30-minute spoof program. It was about, of course, this man who was a bumbling idiot who was the one of the top-notch agents of the Central Intelligence Agency. But go ahead and tell the story, William.
Well, in this particular episode, Maxwell Smart and his sidekick, Agent 99, have been abducted by Hans Siegfried of Chaos, who's their arch nemesis. And they end up aboard a U-boat, a submarine owned by Chaos, and they're under attack, this submarine is, by a U.S. Navy destroyer that's dropping depth charges that are coming perilously close to the sub. And as the depth charges go off in the distance, Siegfried's crew starts to become a little bit uneasy, and 99, seeking to capitalize on the situation, says to Siegfried, look, Siegfried, your men are panicking, to which Siegfried replies, you are wrong about that. My men are thoroughly trained. They will not panic until I give the order to panic. And at that point, a depth charge goes off right next to the submarine, and Siegfried, somewhat rattled, says, prepare to panic. The point here is that he had the luxury of being able to order his men at what point they could panic. What I say is that right now, in the circumstances we confront as heads of households, as consumers, as people who want to have some semblance of economic normalcy in our lives, this is the perfect time to panic. We've not yet been given permission by our rulers to panic, that is to say, to undertake right now, with all appropriate speed and all deliberate action, to provide for the survival of our assets in this rapidly approaching catastrophe. And if we wait until we're given explicit permission to panic, it'll be too late. We'll be caught in the undertow and dragged down. Now, in terms of the auguries of this catastrophe, there are four or five really solid predictions from very respectable people, estimable people who are in the world of high finance and also in the world of market analysis. Just recently on CNN, there was a breathtakingly candid discussion of the upcoming inflationary depression that's sometimes referred to as stagflation, when you have stagnant or even negative growth and high price inflation. It's necessary at this point, by the way, to draw a distinction between price inflation and monetary inflation. Monetary inflation is where the government simply emits currency to the point where it's bringing about a decline in the value of the currency. I mean, every time you create more of something, its value goes down. So when the government emits currency, it is inflating the currency. That's monetary inflation. Price inflation is the effect of monetary inflation. You feel it in terms of rising prices. When the government creates more money, prices go up because it requires more of the debased currency in order to buy the goods or services that you're looking for. And government always gets the benefit of the first use of the inflated currency. So that's an important principle to remember here. But we're headed for an inflationary or hyperinflationary depression. This was discussed on CNN just in the last week or so. And by the time this discussion moves into the realm of CNN or Fox Business News, or when you see it discussed in the pages of major journals and newspapers, it's a pretty sure thing that we're headed in that direction, indeed, that it's already begun. That's one augury of this impending catastrophe. Another one comes from Bernard Connolly, a global strategist at Bank AIG in London, who claims that, and I quote now, the likelihood of a Great Depression is growing by the day. Some of you might be acquainted with Dr. Norio Rabini of New York University's Stern School of Business. About 2 weeks ago, he published, I believe by way of the Reuters News Service, a schematic of 12 steps that outline how the losses in the U.S. financial sector in the aggregate will grow to more than $1 trillion. $1 trillion is 1 million times $1 million, to put that in some sense of perspective. And that amount is equal to all of the assets of all American banks. So, if Dr. Rabini is correct, then Mr. Bernanke is not kidding when he says that we're going to have a bank failure. We're probably going to have a number of bank failures, because the losses in the financial sector are going to be at least the gross equivalent of all of the assets claimed by all of the banks. They don't have assets. Once again, they do not have assets equivalent to $1 trillion. That's what they claim, but they're all fractional reserve banks. So they don't have assets in that realm of numbers. Then there's a commentary from the Intelligencer out of Canada that makes this following point, commenting on Dr. Rabini's analysis. Every day now, thousands of people all over the U.S. and Great Britain are walking away from their homes, simply mailing their house keys to the banks as housing bailout plans fail. With unemployment growing, the next phase that will hit commercial real estate, making the financial institutions the unwilling owners not only of quickly depreciating houses, but also of empty strip malls and even larger shopping centers. That's something we've seen reported, I believe, through the MSN news service on the Internet. They had a very large piece about 2 weeks ago talking about the forthcoming bursting of the commercial real estate bubble. And then, once again, out of the Intelligencer, we continue, the next domino to fall will be credit card defaults. And after that, who knows? There are so many exotic funds out there with trillions of dollars in paper, or rather computer screen money, all carrying assorted acronyms and all about to disintegrate into nothingness. Over the next couple of years, scores of banks that have thrived on these devices based on quickly disappearing equities will fail. Now, how quickly will they fail? And this brings us to the projection from a very elite bulletin, which is put out not only in English but also French and German, called the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin, or GEAB. It's very expensive. It costs about $300 a year for 16 issues. This is something which is circulated among high-end investors and analysts throughout Europe and the United States. And the Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin says the following. the end of the third quarter of 2008, late September, or roughly about 7 months from now, will be marked by a new tipping point in the unfolding of the global systemic crisis. At that time, indeed, the cumulated impact of the various sequences of the crisis will reach its maximum strength and affect decisively the very heart of the systems concerned, the front line of which is the United States, the epicenter of the current crisis. In the United States, this new tipping point will translate into a collapse of the real economy, the final socioeconomic stage of the serial bursting of the housing and financial bubbles and of the pursuance of the U.S. dollar fall. The collapse of the U.S. real economy means the virtual freeze of the American economic machinery, private and public bankruptcies in large numbers, company and public services closing down. They're projecting this once again for some time around September of this year. And that's once again a prediction being made by the people who assemble one of the most highly respected market analysis journals, which is circulated in three languages among people who are really important decision makers in the world of ultra-rarefied finance. And commenting upon that report, the Canadian journal The Intelligencer says the following: "We are not experiencing a remake of the 1929 crisis, nor a repetition of the 1970s oil crises or the 1987 stock market crisis. What we will have instead is a truly global momentous threat, a true turning point affecting the entire planet and questioning the very foundations of the international system upon which the world was organized in the last decade." The report emphasizes that it is first and foremost in the United States where this historic happening is taking an unprecedented shape. The authors call it, quote, very great U.S. depression. It continues to predict that although this crucial event is global, it will be the beginning of an economic decoupling between the United States and the rest of the world. However, non-decoupled economies will be dragged down the U.S. negative spiral. And that's already happening right now. And right now, it's interesting to see how there are at least some of the countries that are involved in importing the United States inflation, helping to monetize our debt by having their central banks peg their currencies to the dollar and inflating their central bank currencies, which of course means that the consumers in these countries have to pay inflated prices, and also that their governments are buying up our treasury notes so as to keep the dollar stable. A lot of these countries are now starting, they have been for a couple of years, they have been flaking off in terms of their purchase of U.S. debt securities, and a number of them are talking about decoupling their currencies from the dollar. And one of the people pursuing this, suggesting this course of action, and tell me if this isn't something that would make the normal person furious to the point of being blind with rage, is Alan Greenspan. He was just in Saudi Arabia a couple of weeks ago at an investors' conference in Jeddah, recommending that investors in the Arab world get out of dollar-denominated assets and that the governments in the region decouple their currencies from the dollar to destroy the dollar peg. This is the individual who did the most in the history of the world to destroy the U.S. dollar. And now, after wreaking this destruction on the U.S. dollar, he's over in the Arab world telling these people to bail out of the dollar. And the consequence of that would be this very great depression that's being described here in this bulletin, this Global Europe Anticipation Bulletin.
Well, I think the reason, of course, Alan Greenspan said this, he's working as a consultant for the Dresden Bank, but mm-hmm. one of the things he says is that you don't want to have inflation here in the Arab countries. You've got to decouple from the American dollar.
Mm-hmm.
What people really don't understand is we have inflation. Certainly, if you read Ben Bernanke's testimony, it was, I think, 27th of February, just a little over 10 days ago. Ben Bernanke said, you know, certainly there's no significant inflation. We've looked at the commodity index, the indexes, and we see no evidence of inflation. Well, ladies and gentlemen, Ben Bernanke is lying.
Yep.
We have inflation that's running at least 10%. And, of course, they have something called hedonics, which is a means of calculating the inflation rate that simply distorts the truth. All you have to do is certainly go to the store, look at the price of gasoline, see what's happening to the prices of healthcare, of medicines, and understand that prices are going through the roof. And Ben Bernanke says there's no inflation. Why would he say that? Because the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that inflation destroys the value of a currency and ultimately the nation. We'll go right ahead there.
Yeah, it's interesting you talk about the fact that people on the basis of the evidence of their eyes and the evidence of their declining household balance sheets should be able to contradict what we're being told in terms of the rate of inflation being as supposedly negligible as the Federal Reserve would tell us. I mean, obviously, if we had a sound currency and a sound economy, we wouldn't have price inflation. But they're talking about pegging inflation to a relatively modest rate. But even if it were only as low as the so-called core inflation rate would have us believe, that would be catastrophic in the long run. But the real inflation rate, as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, is somewhere around 16% at the very least. Just today, for instance, when I was driving around doing errands after our previous conversation on the radio this afternoon, I noticed that here in Payette, Idaho, this is a town of about 7,000 people. It's located right on the Oregon border. And traditionally, we pay less for gasoline in this part of the state than anybody else in the state of Idaho, where the price of gasoline is usually running very, very much lower than what you'd find in California. But between this morning, when I noticed that gas prices had gone up 3 cents a gallon since yesterday, and this afternoon, gasoline prices went up another 4 cents. That's in the course of less than 24 hours. You have a 7 cent increase in the price of a gallon of gasoline here in Payette, Idaho, which is not one of your larger markets for gasoline. If you take a look at what's going on with the price of staple foods in the grocery store, if you're talking about anything that's made out of the basic cereal grains, such as wheat and corn and rice, if you buy breakfast cereals, I'm the father of five small children, we buy breakfast cereal, you notice that the price of breakfast cereal has gone parabolic, and that reflects the fact that wheat is at an all-time high in terms of the price per bushel, and similar things are happening with corn and rice. Some of this is driven, in the case of corn, for instance, by government subsidy of ethanol, which is a horrible boondoggle that should be ended immediately. But a lot of it, most of it, has to do with the fact that the dollar's value is plummeting relative to the market value of the commodity. And if you take a look at what's going on in the foreign exchange realm right now, every single day the dollar digs itself into a new low against the euro, which is another fiat currency issued by an overtly socialist government. And yet the dollar is performing more poorly than the euro. And when you talk once again about core inflation and what we're being told versus what we're experiencing, you mentioned, Dr. Stan, this concept of hedonics, which is one of these incantatory words that the Federal Reserve uses in order to cover up the fundamental dishonesty of what they're doing. The core inflation rate is calculated in a way that strips from that figure the factors of food and energy. In other words, they calculate consumer inflation, price inflation, on the basis of a assembly of figures that have nothing to do with the essentials that we need for living. We cannot live without food. We cannot live a modern life without energy. So they take those out of the inflation calculations in terms of the consumer prices that we pay. And once again, this is something that was discussed on the CNN program just a few days ago. That's one of the grand secrets of the palace, if you will. Not many people in the establishment have been willing to own up to the fact that the core inflation rate is a palpable, deliberate fraud. And yet, that's something that was being overtly discussed on a news service that really doesn't traffic in the truth for the most part. So when the truth has become so obvious that CNN will speak it, we know we're in for some very bad times. Oh, another thing that I think is interesting is that there was a...
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with William Greig about inflation. Inflation, of course, is running about neighborhood of 10%. They are simply lying to the American people. They calculate the rate of inflation now with something known as hedonics, H-E-D-O-N-I-C-S. It's a new means of taking inflation, and you calculate it figuring that, well, the price of beef is going up, so, of course, the price of chicken is not, so people are going to switch from beef to chicken, and so we will not, of course, increase the price of their meat products because now they're going to be eating chicken rather than expensive meat. And, of course, How could you make this sort of an assumption? Certainly they ignore the skyrocketing prices in literally every field, and they do this very specifically. Why? Well, because if they told the truth, since the legislature has linked the Social Security payments to rate of inflation, if it's only 2.1% core inflation, why, if that's all they have to raise the Social Security tax? Whereas, of course, if they told the truth, they'd have to give at least 10% rise every year. The same thing is true with index treasury bills. A lot of people have bought treasury bills that are indexed to inflation. And, of course, if they told the truth, they would have to pay them a 10% increase in the value of the treasury bills every year. But they're not going to do that. It's far easier to lie, and it is an organized program on the part of the bureaucracy in Washington, D.C. to lie so they can steal from the elderly, so they can steal from the people who have bought the Treasury indexed bonds which are indexed to inflation, and, of course, really to conceal the truth of what's going on. So pick it up from there, William.
Well, I have a question for you, Dr. Stan. I don't know this off the top of my head, but it just occurs to me. When Congress votes itself a pay raise, does it vote itself a pay raise based upon the same inflation rate that they use to calculate Social Security payments and the other calculations you're talking about with respect to T-bills and the like? Or do they vote themselves the pay raise based on the real inflation rate?
Well, I really can't answer that, but
okay,
I suspect
I'm gonna look
they're
looking
after themselves rather than looking after you and I.
I'm going to look into that because I suspect the latter is the case. I suspect that when they give themselves a pay raise, that it goes in several multiples of what they do by way of increasing the COLA on Social Security payments or things of that sort. And so that would be a really good way of knowing exactly what the inflation rate is. You take a look at the percentage increase when Congress votes itself a pay raise. I'll take that under advisement and look into it.
Please do it. Let me know what you find.
Yeah, I will. It just occurred to me as we were having this conversation. But when we were talking about the effect of price inflation on staple foods here in the U.S. economy, and as we were talking about that, I happen to remember a piece that I saw on the BBC News Service that I believe was probably republished on Infowars.com or some other source of that variety, where the World Food Program of the United Nations says that food prices for some items rose 40% last year, and they're talking about the impact this is having on a number of economically marginal countries, such as, well, Afghanistan, which is very economically marginal and not a country in any sense that I'd recognize. Bangladesh, you could say the same thing. El Salvador, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Senegal, Morocco. In other words, these places where people live on a pittance and suddenly they find that their subsistence items, such as, you know, wheat, we'd mention the price of wheat, that those prices have gone up between 30% and 40%, people are starting to starve in places like that. So, of course, the United Nations, in its estimable Olympian wisdom, has said that governments now have to take measures in order to control the price of these various food items. Well, if you have price controls, you end up with what? You end up with shortages. You know, if you keep the price artificially low, people aren't going to produce, and so you end up with shortages, and that will, of course, exacerbate the problem of starvation. But I suspect that when we end up going parabolic or hyperbolic here in terms of consumer inflation, we're probably going to see pressure for the same type of non-remedy, the same thing we've seen with respect to gasoline prices and the same thing that brought about what we saw in the late 1970s with the oil crunch. That was in large measure a product of government intervention to prevent the refining of petroleum into gasoline and also government price controls that created artificial scarcity. And I suspect we're going to see the same thing happen here in the United States that we are seeing in these other countries, the biggest difference being that we're wealthier in a subjective sense than these other countries. I mean, we're the biggest debtor nation in the world, so we're not wealthier in an objective sense. But we could see rationing and price controls, and as a result, genuine hunger and perhaps even starvation in this country, perhaps before the end of the decade.
Well, of course, you know, the interesting thing is that rice hit an all-time high within the last two or three days. Wheat has as well. We're seeing a rise in the price of soybeans. We're seeing a rise in the price of all of the staple products, not only in the United States, throughout the world. Even the United Nations is talking about the possibility that we will have to have some sort of a rationing program, and not only in third world nations, but even in first world nations, so there will not be frank famine. People say that could never happen in America. And I would like to say, if God is just, why couldn't it happen in America? Well, Dr. Stan, I guess it's William Griggs who picked the story up there with him.
One thing we have to talk about in terms of the possibility here, the likelihood, I'm saying we're no longer facing a possibility, but we're actually confronting the likelihood, if not the inevitability, of a huge inflationary or hyperinflationary depression in the United States. We have to go back and key on the statement that Bernanke made before Congress last week about there will be bank failures, almost certainly. And we've already seen bank runs erupt in Great Britain and Spain and a couple of other places. One thing that we can learn from the bank run in England involving the Northern Rock Bank is the fact that those larger entities that are supposed to backstop some of these smaller banks, Northern Rock's a fairly large bank, but it's small in the global perspective. But the banks that are supposed to backstop these other smaller banks are not doing so well themselves. The story of Northern Rock, I'll digest it very quickly, is relevant here. Northern Rock is the fifth largest mortgage lender in Great Britain. I think they have something like 80,000 active mortgages on the books. And in September, as they were starting to confront their insolvency crisis, they quietly made a request to the Bank of England, that country's central bank, for assistance. And news of this leaked out to the public. Now, the request was made in order to forestall a run on the bank. And leaking the news, of course, provoked the bank run. And over the course of one weekend, the bank lost $4 billion. It was 4 billion pounds, which would be almost $9 billion, if I remember correctly. 4 billion pounds off its balance sheets as people went in and withdrew their money from the bank. And once again, this is a perfect example of the principle that if you wait until you're given permission to panic, it's too late. The BBC's cameras were on scene as these people were queuing up by the hundreds and thousands to get their money out. And they were all being asked the same question, these depositors were, by the interviewers from the BBC. Isn't this an instance of panic? Isn't this something that represents an irrational reaction or an overreaction to this request for help? And one after another, these smiling, composed people said, no, this is perfectly rational. I mean, what I'm doing is perfectly rational. What we're doing is we're protecting our household assets. There's one of them who said, we've been assured time and time again that there's no problem, but that's what the captain of the Titanic said, wasn't it? Well, Northern Rock lost 4 billion pounds over the course of a weekend, and so we saw the British government working with people from the highest strata of finance get together and talk about a rescue plan for this bank. And one of the people involved was Richard Branson, who's a remarkably successful entrepreneur.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with William. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was talking about, of course, what's happening over in Great Britain as far as the Northern Rock Bank. But before we go into that any further, I'd like William to get his website out. It's a blog site, and then tell you how to get copies of his book. So how can people get your blog site? How can people get copies of your book?
Well, in order to do both, the best and most efficient way to do it is to go to the homepage of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. The Right Source is a news site. It has news stories and commentaries and links to video clips and other multimedia that we find to be worthwhile. The address is www.rightsourceonline.com. That's one word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to the homepage of the Right Source or the Welch Foundation, I work for the Welch Foundation as editor-at-large for their various media enterprises. Go to rightsourceonline.com. At the top of that page, you'll find a banner ad for my new book, which is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. You can order it right there from the website. And if you scroll down about a third of the way down the front page, look at the left-hand margin of the screen, you'll see my photograph, and next to my photograph there will be a hyperlink which will take you to my blog. My blog is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. I update that blog between 3 and 5 times a week, depending upon my schedule. And my intent in publishing that blog is to provide not only a chronicle of the various assaults on liberty and to get people as infuriated as I possibly can over the constant assaults on what remains of our liberty, but hopefully to catalyze people into a state of mind in which they are willing to do something about it, even if that means simply digging in your feet intransigently and not permitting these things to go unchallenged or unremarked. You'd be amazed how much of a difference it would make if people simply would admit the reality of what's happening in our country. And if enough people were to do that, as loudly as possible, as conspicuously as they could, I really believe the change would occur very quickly. And Pro Libertate, the blog, once again, can be accessed through this webpage, rightsourceonline.com, as can the Pro Libertate e-zine or e-journal. There's an infrequently published journal of the same name. We have a new issue in the pipeline for this month that should be available quite soon, and I helped to edit that publication as well. And once again, I want to thank you objectively for your patience and my failures to get you a quantity of the book for sale through Radio Liberty. And as soon as it's all at all possible, I will undertake great exertions to make sure that you have that book to make available to your listeners. I have to say, by way of personal privilege here, that my wife Corinne is now home after a very long hospitalization, and that's a tremendous blessing to me and to our family. We really appreciate your prayers and concerns on our behalf, Dr. Stan, and those of your listeners who have taken an interest in our condition. And that, of course, will make it possible for me to attend to some things with a little bit more diligence than I've displayed previously. I'll be able to attend to little details like making sure that you get that book in quantity so that we can sell it to your listeners.
Well, I certainly don't know how you're able to accomplish what you do, because, of course, with 5 children and no wife to help you, you know, it's a terrible burden. So we certainly understand the quandary you've been in, and we think no less of you, because there's been some delay. We're looking forward to getting the book, though. It's called Liberty in Eclipse, and you can get it right now at rightsource.com. Hopefully one day we'll have it, make it available to our listeners as well. Well, basically, Sidney William was talking about what's going on with Northern Rock Bank in England, and of course, what are they going to do? Here's a bank that's lost a couple of $1 billion. You have to understand that banks have to have assets. They need those reserves. They have to have a fraction of the reserves to back up their lending. In other words, maybe 8, 10, 12%, something like that. But if they don't have reserves, they can't lend. If they can't lend, a bank can't exist. So anyway, Northern Rock is facing a traditional bank run, and it's losing a significant part of its assets, so that the bank faces insolvency. When that happens, of course, they have to call in their loans, or certainly they would be declared bankrupt and either fail, certainly have to sell off all their assets at bargain rate prices, and then the shareholders would lose everything. They're in a terrible strait. So what happened at that point?
What happened at that point was that the government of Great Britain, working with some people in some of the more elitist realms of finance, decided they were going to put together a rescue package for Northern Rock so that the contagion of a bank run wouldn't spread. One of the people they approached was Richard Branson, who's made quite a name for himself as an entrepreneur, both in music and in commercial aviation. He's the fellow who wants to begin civilian space transport as a new means of transportation, where he'd be able to get on a rocket plane in New York and get to Australia in just a couple of hours, that type of thing. He's a visionary, in other words, and a risk-taker. Well, he didn't want anything to do with bailing out Northern Rock Bank unless he had big boys behind him who could provide him with capital. And one of the big boys behind him was Citigroup. Citigroup was going to ride to the rescue of Northern Rock. They were all saddled up, and they were digging their spurs into their mounts, when suddenly it was discovered that, you know what, Citigroup isn't that healthy either. They just received something on the order of a $7 billion bailout from a consortium of Arab investors, and it didn't look as if they were going to be able to do something towards the end of helping Northern Rock. They had to attend to their own ailing balance sheet. And so, as a result, just 2.5 or 3 weeks ago, the government of Great Britain nationalized Northern Rock Bank. And this is not going to be the last time this is going to happen. And it's going to happen across the Atlantic. It's going to happen on this side of the pond as well. But I want to focus a little bit more on Citigroup here. Citigroup, of course, is, if I'm not mistaken, I think the world's largest financial entity of that type. And it's, of course, a hugely respected establishment financial concern. It's sort of one of the marquee names in the world of high finance.
It's actually the largest bank in the United States.
Largest
it's not the
United
largest
States.
Bank in the world. The largest bank in the world is HSBC, which most people don't even know. That's the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, HSBC. It's only recently come to the fore. But remember, it certainly was back in the 1980s where 8 of the 10 largest banks in the world were Japanese banks.
Mm-hmm.
And a decade later, those banks had penny stocks. They were some of the poorest banks. And this may very well be the fate of HSBC. But right now, of course, Citicorp is what they call it. Citicorp is the largest single bank in the United States. And it is on the verge of insolvency. Go right ahead.
And so they received this huge buy-in from two sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf region. Those are government-managed investment instruments, usually created by people, that is to say, governments that are in the business of exporting energy, petroleum, natural gas, things of that sort. I think Norway was the first country to start one. But Kuwait is a sovereign investment fund, and also one of the United Arab Emirates, I believe it was Dubai, also ponied up several million dollars to help rescue Citibank. And then one of the larger Saudi investors, Prince Alawid bin Talal, was also involved in helping to bail out Citigroup. Well, Citicorp. Just a few days ago, there was an item in the Reuters financial press about describing the bailout of Citicorp, and the assessment from the Arab investors was that Citi is in much bigger trouble than they had assumed, and that it's going to have to come up with more capital of its own in order to keep its Arab investors, the philanthropic Arab investors interested in bailing out Citi. Citi's going to have to find some other assets because they're in very, very big trouble. So what that tells me is that Citi, given what we heard in the first segment here about this impending crisis at the end of the third quarter this year, I think Citi is going to be the bellwether bank failure, that Citi's going to go under probably no later than September of this year, and it'll be like the sinking of the Titanic. It'll create a huge vortex that'll begin the process of sucking in just about everything else that's connected to it in the financial sector. And if that happens, we're going to see to alter the metaphor somewhat, a huge financial black hole open up in the middle of the American banking system. And I just don't know how much damage is going to be done, but given the fact that you have these trillions and trillions of dollars out there in investment instruments that very few people can identify or recognize, much less analyze in terms of how to get some kind of capital out of them, I suspect that we're confronting probably the plenary meltdown of the American banking sector. And that brings up another point that I find really interesting. There was an article about 4 or 5 days ago in one of the financial news wires talking about the fact that a lot of people who have gone into default on their mortgages are managing to get by without being evicted from their homes because nobody knows who owns the debt. The debt has been sold so many times and rebundled and repackaged into so many arcane financial instruments that nobody can really establish a chain of possession so that somebody can actually go out and repossess the property in question. And it's gotten to the point where many banks, many lending institutions, I think there are probably 60 or 70 of the major mortgage institutions that went out of business just in the last year or so. So many of those that survive right now are filing what is called missing note affidavits in an attempt to assert ownership over various mortgages. That's just one illustration of the fact that nobody knows what's in these instruments that have been circulated here, these so-called investment instruments that are usually just repackaged garbage loans that have been used as assets for so long. And there's not a bank, there's not a financial entity in this country that is free and clear of this. And so if Citi goes under and starts to pull on that particular thread, I suspect that a whole lot of people are going to be pulled down in the vortex with them. And I think that's probably the crisis that this European newsletter, this global Europe anticipation bulletin is referring to that would happen in September of this year that could trigger what they call the very great American Depression of 2008.
And of course, what we're, another aspect of this, of course, is the derivative mess, and
yep.
somewhere between $600 and $700 trillion in derivatives out there. That's trillion dollars. I mean, there's only about $45 trillion in the whole world, and yet there's $600 trillion in derivatives, and of course these are certain guarantees that the bonds will be paid for, and of course they've made a bet that the municipalities, that the homeowners, that the school boards will pay their bonds, that the company corporations will be able to continue paying the interest on their bonds. But what happens if they don't? Well, then, of course, the companies that have insured that will actually have to come up with the money, but they don't have the money. And some mm-hmm. of the largest companies that deal with the insurance of what they call them derivatives or credit swaps on the collateralized debt obligations, on the asset-backed securities, on the structured investment vehicles, and all these fancy names they give to these vehicles, there's no money to back them up. And that,
yeah.
of course, is going to create tremendous problems. And as Warren Buffett said, derivatives are financial weapons of mass destruction, currently latent but potentially lethal. And I think we're rapidly approaching that point of lethality.
What you're discussing here could be described as better investing through the use of a creative thesaurus. I mean, they have generated all these bogus neologisms, all of these glittering high maintenance terms to describe fraud. I mean, any way you look at it, we're dealing here with a species of fraud. I mean, basically you have a Ponzi scheme of unprecedented proportions that's being disguised through the use of these arcane terms. And this has all been abetted by the Federal Reserve, which is the world's preeminent fraud, perhaps the largest fraud in the history of mankind. Certainly one of the most, if not the most, influential criminal organizations in the history of mankind. It's nothing more or less than a counterfeiting entity. It's the official counterfeiting arm of the regime that rules us. But when we talk about what's likely to happen late this year or perhaps next year, one of the things I mentioned this afternoon, Dr. Stan, that I think bears repeating here is the prediction by John Williams, who publishes a website called U.S. Government Shadow Statistics. This is a fellow who is in charge of publishing the real statistics about inflation, about the size of our debts, of our outstanding financial obligations, both the government and, of course, the larger financial system. His web address is www.shadowstats.com. That's S-H-A-D-O-S-T-A-T-S, shadowstats.com. John Williams has the following to say about what's likely to happen, in his opinion, almost inevitable, over the next couple of years, a year and a half. And I quote, "If not for systemic intervention and manipulations by the Federal Reserve, it appears we might be contemplating a collapsed U.S. banking system and a looming deflationary Great Depression that could have dwarfed the bad times of the 1930s. Such is the good news. The bad news is that with those same systemic interventions, the Fed is locking in a hyperinflationary Great Depression in the decade ahead, with the turmoil possibly breaking by 2010 or earlier." So what he's saying is that basically, by 2010, we're going to see and feel the effects of a hyperinflationary depression. I believe that we're already seeing the beginning, that we're past the point of having the first pebbles of the avalanche. Right now, we're looking around and we're seeing this collapsing, this cascade of debris collapsing upon us and saying, okay, how bad is this likely to get? Well, we don't know how bad it's likely to get. We can make something of an educated guess, but nobody knows for sure what volume we're going to be dealing with here in terms of the actual damage. But one thing is certain, if people do not take steps right now to protect their wealth and their earnings by minimizing their debt, getting out of debt to the extent possible, it has to be done right away. If you can at all, by any means, get out of debt, do it right away. And also by diversifying out of the dollar into something that represents a permanent store of value, precious metals particularly, and also buy some of the physical assets you're going to need in the event of severe price spikes in food or energy. That's something that we have to look forward to as well, I'm afraid. People have to take those steps right now while things are still relatively tranquil, and while the pain that would be incurred by taking the necessary steps would be relatively minimal. If they don't do that right now, it's going to be too late. If you wait until early next year, chances are it's going to be too late. If you wait till this fall, chances are it's going to be too late. And one thing that I want to ventilate here is just a possibility, just a subject that would be the grounds for some useful speculation, is this following question. If, may God save us from such a fate, we have a huge market meltdown and financial collapse sometime in September, what's going to happen around November when the election comes around? That's just something I would like to see discussed and examined soberly but urgently.
Well, I think that we're going to see this is going to be one of the most exciting years of our lives. I'm firmly convinced of it. Our guest this evening has been William Grigg. And, of course, the website is www.rightsourceonline.com. RightsourceOnline.com. His book can be purchased there. The Eclipse of Liberty. The Eclipse of Liberty. Ladies and gentlemen, we are facing losing our liberty. But, of course, as William points out, an eclipse is a temporary event. Of course, the light disappears and it's dark, but of course you can come out on the other end. We're just going to have to wait and see what happens. Hang on there, William. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, it's my hope, and I don't know if it's a forlorn hope or a fruitful one, that when what we're describing comes about, I don't see how we can avoid it, that something of the resilient decency and strength and industry of the American character will assert itself. And I know, and you know, Dr. Stan, that there are millions of people in this country who are conversant with the principles of our founding fathers, with the principles of sound money. They're people who organize their lives according to God's law as they understand it, as they've been given wisdom to understand what God desires of us. The Ten Commandments, the golden text from the Old Testament, the golden rule, the two great commandments, love the Lord thy God and love your neighbor as yourself. There are millions of people in this country who still strive to live according to those precepts. And I believe that one thing that's going to happen is that we're going to see a shakeout here. That people who are trying to live according to those elevated principles are going to do relatively well. And I'm not abundantly optimistic about what our country is going to look like a year and a half or so from now in terms of the economy, in terms of social cohesion and social peace. But I do know that one ironic blessing that can come out of this is if we have a circumstance where those who are held in allegiance to the current system of things through mercenary motivations are freed from that allegiance by virtue of the fact that the government's simply not going to be able to pay them. What those people will do, I don't know. I mean, some of them are likely to become very troublesome. But if we have a situation where people are attracted into the service of our country and our republic and our constitution, in whatever way that might be, out of high principle and genuine ideals, I believe that we could do something about reconstructing our republic, rebuilding it on the foundation that still exists, although we've ignored it for very, very long, and now we're starting to reap the consequences of ignoring it. So I'm not, as I said, overwhelmed with optimism, but I do think that one advantage that can come out of a financial collapse of this sort is that it would delegitimize the system that created it. And my hope is that instead of going to the left, as it were, and embracing totalitarianism, that this country will have a renaissance of small r Republican principles. And that's what I'm working for. I don't know if it's going to happen, but I do know I'm going to do everything I can within my limited means to bring it about.
Well, if we don't try, why, of course, we will certainly fail. And only God knows what the ultimate outcome is going to be. But you're doing the best you can. I'm doing the best that I can. And I know there's similar people out all across America who still treasure freedom. Good night, William. Thank you so very much for being with us again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William was just saying that we're heading towards a total collapse of the system. It can go one of two ways. It can go into a tyrannical dictatorship, which is what the establishment wants, or it could return to a concept of individual freedom under God, the Republican concept, the small r, having nothing to do with the Republican Party, because both political parties are controlled by the same people today. But that idea of a Christian republic with limited government and individual freedom under God, which was the very essence of America, that is what we should be working for, and that's what we can strive for, because we're moving into a crisis situation. It may give us the only opportunity to regain our freedom. So if you need to have more information on what's going on, let me suggest we have two inexpensive pamphlets. One is called The Financial Meltdown. The second is called The History of Money. They're compilations of our newsletters, and you can get them on the Internet, or certainly you get the pamphlets which we make up. They're convenient to have just to read and reread. We have now back in stock, back in print, The Creature from Jekyll Island by Ed Griffin. I think this last weekend we got a supply of them. 20 of them went out simply all over the world through our Amazon website. And then, of course, we also have the book, The Federal Reserve Conspiracy, written by Professor Sutton before he passed away. And then, of course, we carry several of his books, Gold for Investment and Gold for Security, as I remember. Anyway, the two books on gold by Professor Sutton. And then that wonderful little book that goes into the history of what happened in France in 1789 when they did exactly what we're doing today. It's called Fiat Money Inflation in France, because that's what we have today, fiat money inflation. And then, of course, to understand, there is a spiritual force behind everything going on today. And if you doubt that, why, we'd be glad to send you, without charge, a little pamphlet we carry called The Spiritual Hierarchy. Now, of course, it's put out by the Luciferians, by the Lucis Trust. They distribute it. But they tell you that they have their agents in finance and in positions of power all throughout the world today. The Spiritual Hierarchy, if you'd like to get the pamphlet. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Of course, we hope that you'll get my, seriously consider getting the book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That's Brotherhood of Darkness, or the talk on the Forbidden Secret. That's the Forbidden Secret. It's actually the DVD. It's got a syllabus with it. If you'd like to know more about any of the items we've mentioned or the suggested gift to obtain them, you can always call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. To understand the true essence of what we're up against, let me suggest Pastor Joe Schimmel's wonderful DVDs, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. The 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour versions of They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. Why is that important? Why, because, of course, there are many people in the music industry who made a pact with the devil, and they will openly admit it. And, of course, they get great wealth and great power and great influence in this life. But, of course, where will they spend eternity? We want you to understand that there truly is a spiritual component to everything, and it exists not only in the music industry, but in finance, in politics, in education. And that's, of course, why it's so vitally important. You read the book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, or watch our CD, which, incidentally, we just got 1,000 copies of that in, and they are available through Radio Liberty. We hope, of course, you'll want to get the 4-tape or 4-CD set on the supernatural and the book that goes with that called The Beautiful Side of Evil, written by Johanna Michelson, who was a medium. And she possessed those supernatural gifts, which are given to those that, of course, have gone to the dark side. Now, Joanna will be a speaker at our special conference here on the 26th of October this year. We hope that you'll plan on coming. Dr. Russell Blaylock will be here with us. We're going to have a great program. That's the 26th of October. Give our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders, but pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Afternoon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is Toys Day, the 5th of June, 2008.